can't make it harder for good, solid, law-abiding citizens to protect themselves. We will always uphold the right to self-defense, and we will always uphold the Second Amendment. We will.
President Trump at a rally in Manchester, New Hampshire last night. He also promised to keep guns out of the hands of people who suffer from mental illness, repeating the oft-quoted line that it's not the gun that pulls the trigger, but the person holding the gun. Trump told reporters last week that the National Rifle Association would be fully represented and respected as the White House and Congress try to stem the epidemic of gun violence in America. But the NRA's influence may be waning due to both long-simmering, self-inflicted turmoil and resentment after this summer's trio of mass shootings in Texas, Ohio, and California. Anita Kumar wrote about this for Politico. She's their White House reporter and associate editor. And welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with what's going on within the organization. Why don't you bring us up to date on the recent scandals and the power struggles among NRA leadership?
Sure. There's just been so many different things going on. But one of the things is that the New York Attorney General is looking at its tax-exempt status, and there's been a lot of people that have been documented and a lot of people that have been subpoenaed, so there's all sorts of turmoil with that. But there's something that other people might have heard about more that's gotten more of the headlines, which is just sort of infighting. And there's a lot of people that think the CEO who's there now, Wayne LaPierre, has been engaged in lavish spending. There was a recent headline that said the NRA was going to put up $6.5 million to buy him a mansion. So there's a lot of people just concerned about the spending. What's happened over the last couple months is that we've seen that the president, Oliver North, left. The very powerful top lobbyist, Chris Cox, left. And Cox is very close to a lot of members of Congress. He's also pretty close to the president and the president's son, who's an avid hunter, Donald Trump Jr. So we see a lot of, you know, sort of significant changes happening.
And there are even more things to add to that list. Didn't the ad agency that has been with the NRA for nearly four decades quit?
It did. Ackerman McQueen left. That was also part of another dispute. I think what you're seeing is a lot of people sort of taking sides. Is the current leadership what they want, or do they think there needs to be a change? And people really disagree about that. I mentioned a couple people who had left, but there's a lot of lower level people that have also left as things are getting shuffled around. So one of the things that they have done is the lobbying arm of the NRA, which Chris Cox oversaw. They had their own public relations team there. That's been moved over to the other part of the NRA. And, you know, some of this might sound like minutia, but when you're trying to combat and fight legislation or convince lawmakers or the president of the United States about things, you need all those people in place, because otherwise people don't really know what to do, or they're not responding very quickly, or they're not getting their message out on social media. All of those things can come to play.
Well, are lawmakers responding to any of this, or their aides? Are you hearing anything that can give you a handle on how to measure the NRA's ability to lobby on Capitol Hill?
Well, you know, it is recess time here in Washington, which means obviously members of Congress have all gone back to their districts. So things are a little bit quieter than usual. It's never very quiet here. But we are hearing from a lot of the aides, at offices, and these are Republican offices, that they haven't heard from the NRA or they haven't heard from NRA members. And what you might expect at this point, when the president and the Senate Majority Leader are talking about legislation, you might think that the NRA would send out an alert and say, you know, to their members, call your member of Congress and tell them that you don't want this bill. Of course, there's not a very specific bill at this point. So it's possible it's just really early and they haven't done that. But I have talked to other groups on the same side of the NRA, and they say they're worried because they should be already activating that membership and calling people, and there shouldn't be Republican Senate offices that haven't heard from them.
And when they say they're worried, what does that really mean? You know, if the NRA is weakened politically, does that mean there's this window for Congress or the White House to push through significant gun control legislation?
Yeah, I think since the shootings in Ohio and Texas, there are a couple things going on. One is, when we've seen this before, is the momentum around the country is really high. People want something to get done. If you look at polls, you'll see even Republicans, even gun owners, want some things to get done. And so I'll use universal background checks as one of those things. We had a poll a couple weeks ago that showed that 90% of people wanted it. Even Republicans, even gun owners were for background checks for commercial sales. So there's certain things that people really want to happen. We've seen this before. And what happens is people are really supportive, and then, you know, interest wanes over time until the next mass shooting. But the other thing you're seeing is that because the NRA is not strong, and this has been a very, very strong organization that helps people get elected and helps people lose elections, because of that, there are Republicans who are feeling that there won't be repercussions if they vote against the NRA. So let's say they vote for a bill that they know the NRA doesn't like or doesn't support. They're not so worried at the moment that at their next election, the NRA is going to come in there and buy a bunch of ads and against them and, you know, work hard against that person. Now, this could all change. The NRA, I've talked to a lot of people who say, oh, they're going to come back and rebuild themselves very quickly and change things. So we don't know. What we do know is that the president and some members of Congress feel that there's a very brief window here. There's a small opening that if they wanted to get something done and get something passed, this is the time to do it.
You've kind of anticipated my next question, but you've been covering this turmoil in the organization for a while now. What are your sources telling you, or how are they, your sources, responding to this idea that is the NRA losing influence?
Well, I can tell you what the NRA says. They, you know, pushed back very hard. They're saying that any negative publicity now, anyone saying that they're not as strong as they used to be, is because they are the NRA's political enemies, that they don't like the leadership and that sort of thing. And I will say that they claim that they have had some victories recently, even since this change has been going on in the last couple months. And the one specific thing they turn to is in Virginia, in Richmond, Virginia, the governor called a special legislative session to try to see if the legislature could pass gun laws. Now, the legislature is Republican, so, you know, they're probably not very interested in doing that. But the NRA declares victory. They said that there were no gun laws, gun restrictions passed there, and so they helped cause that, or they helped have, you know, that to happen. I'm not sure that they can claim victory completely on that, but they probably were a factor.
And is it helpful to follow the money in every way, for instance, in terms of how much money the NRA is spending on federal elections to gauge influence?
Yeah, and the amount that they spent has gone down when you look at the midterm elections, so where they were 4 years ago as opposed to 2018. So that has gone down. You know, I have talked to people that have talked to the president or heard from the president about this, and he uses the word that the NRA is on the verge of going bankrupt. The word he uses, bankrupt. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but I think what President Trump means there is that they are in a spiral, right? They're not doing as well. The money isn't coming in. Donors aren't as happy. And so they aren't as influential. And I think that he knows that.
So what are you expecting once President Trump returns from his vacation in Bedminster, New Jersey? Any action on this issue?
So a lot of White House aides, some of the legislative staff of the White House, have been meeting with aides of members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, to try to come up with some proposals for the president to look at next week when he's back. So those proposals will both be legislation that Congress would have to act on, but they'll also be executive actions that maybe the president could take by himself. Now, you know as well as I do that it's still a big, big hurdle, right? It's still an uphill battle, and it's really possible that nothing could happen. But it's also possible that they could try to pass a couple bills. The two that we hear the most about are the background check bill and also this red flags bill, which is something that, you know, if someone has something in their past that makes you think that they could be a harm to themselves or to others, it would prevent them from getting a gun. That's what generally when people are sort of generically talking about mental illness or, you know, we shouldn't let certain people have guns. That's kind of what they're talking about. That bill is pushed by a big Trump ally, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. So it's possible the president will listen to him on that and really take a good look at that.
Anita, thanks for this.
Thank you.
Anita Kumar is White House reporter and editor for Politico. Speaking of red flag laws, coming up, we meet the most aggressive enforcer of California's red flag law aimed at removing firearms from potentially violent people, San Diego City Attorney Mara Elliott. That's next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave. Moving now from a national to a local take on gun control. In San Diego, City Attorney Mara Elliott has been leading the charge for stricter gun control measures. She started out specializing in finance and contracts and thought guns were not her lane. But mass shootings throughout the country galvanized her as an attorney and as a parent. She ended up running for office and pushed through San Diego's red flag measure, which keeps guns out of the hands of people who show the potential for violence. Mara Elliott joins me now, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Barbara.
So when did you have this come-to-Jesus moment on gun control? Was it Sandy Hook, or did it start earlier than that?
It was Sandy Hook, and I still remember the day that I heard the news. I was dropping my children off at school. One was in kindergarten, and one was in second grade. And the children of Sandy Hook who were murdered were kindergartners and first graders, so it hit me very hard, I think, as most parents would feel, and you question whether you're putting your child in a safe place when you drop them off at school. And as you mentioned in your introduction, that's not the type of work I was doing for the city attorney's office. I was a deputy at that time, and I always questioned whether there was something more that we at the city level could do. As a parent, I did everything I could. I looked at the school safety plans. I asked the right questions, but I just didn't feel like I was doing enough. The law that came about that has given us this enforcement tool arose after the shootings in Isla Vista. And that was back in 2014 when the shootings occurred. The law came into effect in January of 2016. And that allowed us to act before violence occurs by removing access to a gun from somebody who could be a danger to themselves or to others. And so this is not unique to the city of San Diego. This is a statewide law that any jurisdiction can use. It just was a tool that came to our attention, probably more for me because of my own personal experience.
Yeah, and tell us more about the red flag measure. How does it work, and who can raise an alarm to police about so-called suspicious behavior?
The city attorney's office here in San Diego works with the police department. They're our client. And the police department themselves will notify us if they believe that there is somebody who is at risk to themselves or to a community member. Our public can call and make a report to the police department, and that's how it starts for us. So the police department does their investigation. They give us the information that we need here at the city attorney's office to pursue the gun violence restraining order. We bring our request to a judge who is unbiased and looks at both sides. And if the judge determines that this person poses a significant risk to themselves or to others, then their gun or their access to guns is removed for up to 12 months.
So does this mean that police are monitoring social media or forums like sites like 8chan? Or is it that they're being notified by family members or concerned citizens?
I think it's a little of both, but I would say generally it is the latter, where the police department either is witnessing something themselves or they're being notified by a member of the public. And we really do depend upon the eyes and ears of our community members, because we just don't have the resources. And I don't think any government agency has the resources to monitor everything that's happening on social media.
And can you give us some specific examples when you've had to enforce this?
Yeah, we have seen examples in just about every setting you can imagine, from DV stalking type cases to hate crimes. We've had threats in the schools or in the workplace. A lot of these are what we would envision happening, where there's perhaps a bad breakup and someone's threatening to shoot or kill their ex, and they show up at their home. We've had folks who are going through a divorce, and we've got husbands threatening to shoot the wife or children. In the workplace, one of our earliest cases involved a car dealership employee who made comments glorifying the Vegas shooter, and then said he would shoot up the dealership if he were ever fired, and this person was having employment problems, so his coworkers were very concerned about the comments. We've had, I think especially recently, some hate crime concerns here. We've had cases where individuals have threatened to shoot up a gay bar or kill Muslims. We had recently an individual who made threats about an English language school, and he said that he didn't want these, and he used an expletive describing the individuals who attended that school. He didn't want them in his community, and he made some very political comments. So we've seen all types of circumstances happening, and that's the benefit of a law like this, is it's not a cookie-cutter case. If you see the indicators, that will give us an opportunity to step in, examine the situation, and if we have a case, we bring it to a judge.
Well, how many guns have been seized? And related and important question, how do you measure success? I mean, have there been fewer shootings in San Diego?
So we have seized about 400 firearms, including about 40 assault rifles. We have obtained a little over 300 gun violence restraining orders. And we will never know how many lives we've saved because we've prevented violence from occurring. But we always ask ourselves after we read about or hear about a mass shooting whether a gun violence restraining order might have prevented that tragedy. And most often we believe the answer is yes, because typically somebody has seen the indicators of a shooter's intent to harm other people. So whether it's a threat to a school or workplace, partner or stranger, or a threat of suicide, our office has found gun violence restraining orders to be a powerful tool for saving lives.
Well, you also proposed an ordinance that passed the San Diego City Council, a safe storage of firearms ordinance. What does that require?
That requires an individual who has access to or owns a firearm to carefully store it. And if the person has the firearm on their body or in their immediate control, then the ordinance is not stepping into place. Where my concern is when they are not safeguarding that firearm, when it is not locked up or not within their immediate control. And we had a circumstance in my own community where a 10-year-old boy found an unsecured firearm in a garage of a neighbor, and this was a garage where the kids just hung out and played. And a 10-year-old boy, being a 10-year-old boy, had that firearm in his hand and set it off and killed himself. And that's something that I really want to prevent from happening in our own communities. And it's such an easy thing to prevent if we take the appropriate safeguards.
Historically, San Diego, though, is a pretty conservative city. It's a military city. What kind of pushback have you gotten from constituents?
I have not heard viable pushback, because when you purchase a firearm nowadays, you have to have a lock device that comes with it. The Attorney General of the state of California has posted information for every gun owner, and there are well over 1,000 such devices. We're not dictating how somebody stores their gun, because there are so many alternatives available. We just want them properly stored. And I think most people appreciate that that is a good safeguard. We would do that with any powerful tool, keeping it out of the hands of children. And I think most of us are on the same page with regard to firearm safety.
What about pushback in general on stricter gun control? And I'm thinking just yesterday, the San Diego County Gun Owners Political Action Committee filed a federal lawsuit challenging California's assault weapon ban.
I have heard a little bit of pushback, and I think some of the concerns are viable, and I'm cognizant of them and responsive to them. One of the concerns I heard when we met with the San Diego County gun owners was that they wanted to make sure that false reports were not being filed. So if a neighbor had a problem with a gun owner, they weren't just making something up and filing it. And I could not agree more with that, and we would take any such false report very seriously and prosecute that. So we have made that part of our messaging. And we're also careful with any case that we bring forward. We look at it to make sure we have sufficient evidence, because the last thing we want to do is cause anybody to have concern about the manner in which we're using these restraining orders. It's a good tool, and we need to protect its ability to save lives. My ears are always open to concerns. So that was one that we responded to. The other was ensuring due process. And as I explained when we first started speaking, it's not the city attorney who makes a decision about somebody's ability to have a firearm or access, and it's not the police department. Ultimately, that rests with a judge who's going to hear both sides of the story before issuing a ruling. So that process will allow the gun owner to have an attorney, to present evidence, to plead their side of the story to a judge. And those are really important safeguards.
Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Maura Elliott, San Diego City Attorney. Coming up, in the early days of Silicon Valley, investors knocked on barn doors looking for the next big thing. And the conversation often went something like this.
What are you doing? I'm a venture capitalist. And the guy would say, what's that? He's like, I'm someone who can invest in you. I can give you some money. I'm going to invest in you. And the guys in the prudent shed would often say, well, come right on in.
A new book traces the history of Silicon Valley, its mavericks and its myths. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Madeline Brand. In the last 50 years, the tech industry has reshaped America. It's changed how we communicate, our economy, and our political landscape. The captains of this industry, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, they've all become some of the richest people in history. And it all happened in Silicon Valley, a storied high-tech Galapagos where daring entrepreneurs found equally daring investors willing to roll the dice on risky new ventures, realized by armies of technological whiz kids, all remote from and free of the stultifying influence of the federal government. That's the line Silicon Valley and its denizens have touted, anyway. Historian Margaret O'Meara says it's a self-serving myth that belies Silicon Valley's humble beginnings as a remote Cold War research and development hub and the deep ties it fostered with the U.S. government. How Silicon Valley went from obscurity to global powerhouse is the subject of O'Meara's new book, The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. O'Meara's a professor of history at the University of Washington, and she joins me now. It's good to have you on the show.
It's terrific to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you have written a revisionist history of sorts. Why is that needed? You know, what's the danger of thinking of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs as these lone cowboys?
Well, I think tech is all around us. Tech is no longer off to the side. We're using its products every day. And so realizing how we got to now and realizing that it's a story not only of entrepreneurship, but also of politics and culture is really important to understanding where we go next.
Ah, now that's interesting. So, and we're going to get to that, but let's go back to the beginning now.
Yeah.
Why did Palo Alto become the hub of all of this tech? And as you point out in the book, it was just this sleepy railroad village in the 1950s. But you say two things made a big difference. The bomb and then Southern Pacific Railroad tycoon Leland Stanford.
That's right. Leland Stanford, who, of course, was a man of the 19th century, not the 20th or 21st. But in 1885, he and his wife endowed and founded a university. And 60 years later, that university becomes the hub of a growing electronics industry in a valley that before that had mostly been a place of fruit production and canneries. It was the beginning of a complete transformation. And the catalyst for that was not just the fact that Stanford was there and not just the fact that private industries and companies like Lockheed, LA-based Lockheed, opened a major division up there, but also because the federal government got into the research and development business in a big way for the first time in the 1950s.
And then there, these two threads run side by side, Stanford and Cold War industry, because you write that Stanford helped shift the center of tech away from MIT in Boston, mm-hmm. which was historically the first hub of technology and innovation. So what was it about Stanford that made it so uniquely suited to being that lab of this burgeoning military-industrial complex?
Well, Stanford did what no other university did, which was it really completely reorganized itself to meet the needs of the burgeoning Cold War military-industrial complex. And this is a really important thing to understand. You know, one of the reasons I wrote this book is because I've spent two decades looking at the history of tech and having people ask me here and around the world, how, you know, where's going to be the next Silicon Valley? How do I build a Silicon something? And often that other regions have looked at the Bay Area and said, aha, if we have a university there, then we're just going to, you know, we can build a tech cluster adjacent to it, not recognizing how distinct Stanford was. It was a private university that had an immense degree of latitude to kind of change the way it worked. And the people who ran the university in the 50s and the 60s, notably its dean of engineering and then provost, a guy named Fred Terman, decided to really reorganize the entire curriculum to beef up physics, to create these really powerful research labs that were devoted to things like microwave and radar technology, as well as small and advanced electronics. No other place did that.
And Fred Terman was the guy who lured Hewlett-Packard out, right?
Yeah, the secret of Silicon Valley is not just the tech, it's the people. Right. And Fred Terman is a really important character in the early parts of this book because he is not only situated at this key role at Stanford, but he is so instrumental in personally bringing out people and encouraging them to start companies there.
Is another important distinction between Stanford and MIT, say, that Stanford encouraged people to work outside of academia for companies, you know, mm-hmm. themselves, and also that the companies didn't make their employees sign non-competes. So you had that flow of labor.
Yeah. So the non-compete is a really important California hallmark of kind of why California and why Northern California, because the state of California, unlike other states, including the state of Washington, where I am, allows people to job hop and doesn't penalize them. You know, non-compete agreements are not allowed by under California state law. I think that Stanford has this, you know, creates this model for collaboration with industry and creating an opportunity, as you said, for both faculty and students to go back and forth between academia and industry. And that was not done then. That was something that no other university was doing. And other parts of Stanford looked on with some horror as higher education kind of selling out to an industry.
Yeah, to give them this bad reputation in the halls of academe.
Oh, yeah.
Another big part of this story is the post-1957 space race. You know, Sputnik mm-hmm. and Kennedy is putting a man on the moon. That started or sparked this startup explosion in Silicon Valley. So how did that get more money flowing to individual entrepreneurs? And why were they so often based here in the West?
Yeah. Well, this is a really great part of the story. And it's really important, too, to sort of show how the story of the Valley is not just big government and it's not just entrepreneurship. It's both. And it's actually the way not only the government spending money, but how it flowed. So, look, you come into the 1950s and you have a lot of electronics, a lot of aerospace, a lot of military related activity going on up and down the West Coast. But when you think about both L.A. and Seattle, you think about building big, building airplanes, building, you know, aerospace. I mean, not exclusively, but that's kind of the dominant, the characteristic of the industry was, you know, building big things. The Valley was already building small things. It was a small place and it was building small electronics and communications devices. Well, after October 1957, when America's, you know, the White House's hair is on fire, metaphorically, because the Soviets have been the first one to get a satellite into orbit. There's this huge push for more spending on space. The space race kicks off, it, you know, goes into overdrive. And with that starts flowing, you know, what do you need to build more powerful rockets to send a man to the moon? You need very small, very light, very powerful electronics devices. And that is exactly what the Valley is building.
And as more startups settled in the West, you have the rise of the venture capitalists. And it's really interesting to read in your book about the dawn of that whole game. Did early venture capitalist guys actually drive around Palo Alto looking for signs of nerdy men working on something in their garages that they could invest in?
They did. It's amazing. The venture capitalists at the beginning were not these, you know, rich swaggering guys. They weren't someone, many of them weren't people who had a great deal of their own money. They were young, smart guys, many of them with business degrees, who were managing other rich people's money for them. And one of the stories I tell in the book is one that was told to me by Bill Draper, one of these legendary venture capitalists whose father was a VC, whose son and other family members have become very prominent venture capitalists. And Bill Draper talks about driving around with his then business partner, Pitch Johnson, another person I interviewed for the book, and how they would just go out in the plum orchards and look for these old sheds that used to be used for drying prunes that might have this sort of sign that was tacked up outside with some funny name that kind of ended in Tron or some kind of made up electronic sounding name. And they would show up and they would knock on the door and they'd say, "Hey, what are you doing? I'm a venture capitalist." And the guy would say, "What's that?" He's like, "I'm someone who can invest in you. I can give you some money. I'm going to invest in you for some upside in your company." And the guys in the prune shed would often say, "Well, come right on in. We'll show you what we're doing."
So quaint.
It is. It is very quaint. But it's a wonderful image to think about these young men getting up early in the day and just driving around looking for deals. And as another VC I talked to for the book, Reed Dennis, told me, like, in those early days, there was just so much. There was so much opportunity out there, and there was very little competition. No one else was really tracking this stuff. None of the big money guys, certainly none of the East Coast money men, were paying any attention to these little companies. The California electronics industry and the Northern California electronics industry matures. You start getting this generation of men who kind of come out and they work in these industries. And I'm saying men again and again deliberately. So this was an all-male, all-white world at the time.
And they're still so white and so male. I mean, not that much has changed. Looking into this whole history, how has that informed why there hasn't been much progress mm-hmm. there?
Well, the magic of the Valley is its network. It's a small place. Everyone else's neighbor. They're all drinking together after work. Their kids play Little League together. And in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, you know, this is where what the American professional workforce was like. Certainly the engineering workforce was almost exclusively male and white. And so it replicates itself, and the people, and you hire who you know, you fund who you know. And that is, again, the secret of this ecosystem, that's it's tightly networked, and you're drawing on circles of known acquaintance. But when you do that, it's a lot harder to look outside and say, is there someone that I don't know, or someone who didn't go to this program, or gosh darn it, someone who's a different gender or a different ethnicity or different background, who doesn't look like or sound like or seem like the people who've come before? And should I take a bet on them?
Well, in the book, you say it was good that Silicon Valley wasn't regulated by the government and that genius was able to run free. But now, of course, we are seeing the downside of that, violations of privacy, monopoly, a lack of responsibility for content posted on sites, and the list, we could go on and on. So how does your understanding of all of the industry's history inform your ideas about how Silicon Valley should be regulated today?
Well, I think one of the virtues of looking at a history of the Valley that puts the government back in and shows the way in which government action and regulation was generative and enabled some of the things that Silicon Valley was able to do is a way of reminding us that regulation does not necessarily have to choke off innovation. And it also is to remind us that, you know, the Valley is very different than it was even 20 years ago. And so I think, you know, smart regulation shouldn't be feared. We are at a moment that's very similar to the moment that the United States wrestled with in the early 20th century, where you had these new industries that had grown very large, including some important California-based industries, oil and railroads, that had become incredibly large and powerful, kind of in the absence of any controlling regulation. And that had enabled the creation of immense wealth, that had enabled the creation of sort of fast-forward technological advancement. But it was clear that there needed to be some countervailing force. And the great debate that was going on in the era of Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft and Woodrow Wilson, both in the White House and in Congress and in state legislatures, was what should the government do? And how can you keep this economic engine going, but not going in a way that's crushing other things? And that's the same challenge we have now.
Margaret, good to talk with you today.
Great to talk to you, too. Thanks for having me.
Margaret O'Meara is a professor of history at the University of Washington and the author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. Coming up, sharks, a magician, a vanishing room, and a Pakistani Muslim living in London falls hard for Bruce Springsteen. It is a grab bag of summer movies. Our film guys tell you what's what. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, and happy Friday, everyone. I hope you get to cool off this weekend at the movies. Thankfully, Alonzo Duralde and Dave White are here to tell us what's worth seeing. Both review for The Wrap and host the movie podcast Linoleum Knife, and it's great to talk with both of you.
Hello.
Hi there. So let's start with 47 Meters Down, Uncaged. It's a sequel to the 2017 thriller of the same name, this time with a completely different cast.
Hi. Cave diving is dangerous.
Cave diving is dangerous.
No, Mia is right, Nicole. I don't really know about this.
Look, we come all this way and we don't even see the temple. Really?
It's unlike anything you've ever seen before. We should just go in, go once around the first cave and then out.
Yeah, come on.
Guys, cave diving is dangerous. What should they not have done, Dave?
they should have never gotten in that water. See, Mandy Moore learned her lesson about sharks and water and going places and doing things in the first movie and did not come back for this one. So they've got four new, this time teenagers, Corinne Fox, Sistine Rose Stallone, Sophie Nelisse, and Brianne Hsu, all of them unwisely donning scuba gear and going into an underwater cave where there are, oops, sharks. And so they are trapped in an underwater cave that is also a maze with sharks.
Well, look, but the first movie, it was a sleeper hit.
It was, and it was exciting, and it was thrilling, and it was cheap and fast and cool and a lot of fun. This one is a bore. An absolute bore. And Alonzo disagrees, so I'm going to let him.
Oh, Alonzo. Okay.
Well, look, I'm not going to, this is not a hill I'm going to die on, but I think, and it's not as good as the first 47 Meters Down, but it does deliver B-movie, what if sharks, but also potential drowning and claustrophobia. Like, there's plenty of that. So I was.
That's a triple header.
I am admittedly an easy mark for the PG-13 horror movie because I am a total fraidy cat. Dave White is Mr. I've seen all the horror movies. You know, I clench my buttocks and jump scares do nothing for me. But I am, you get me every time with that shark coming out of nowhere.
Well, that's right.
Sticking its face into the cavern.
I have seen all the shark movies and there have been a lot of them, you know, right?
Since Jaws, for sure. This movie is no Crawl, I'll say that, which was the great alligator movie that Paramount sadly under marketed earlier this summer. But, you know, I was entertained. It's 89 minutes, and I felt like there's very little padding. It is, they get in that water pretty quickly, and then it's just shark, shark, shark.
Okay, so it's really up to the individual. We have a thumbs every which way basically on this one. Okay, moving on to Richard Linklater's Where'd You Go, Bernadette? It's based on the best-selling novel of the same name and stars Kate Blanchett.
You can't honestly believe any of this nonsense. As amusing as it is, it obscures the larger point, which is that people like you must create. That's what you were brought into this world to do, Bernadette. If you don't, you become a menace to society. I think there's one very simple answer to all of your problems. Get your ass back to work and create something.
Well, that is an unmistakable voice, but I should say anyway, it's Lawrence Fishburne.
Yes.
And this is a great cast.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, Dave, tell us who else is in the
Kate
movie
Blanchett,
and how the movie is.
Billy Crudup plays her husband. Their daughter is played by newcomer, Emma Nelson. But there's a whole lot of very cool character actor people
Greer.
In here. Judy Greer, James Urbaniak, Kristen Wiig, Megan Mullally, Chloe Zhao, Steve Zahn. A lot.
David Paymer.
It is.
So what does it add up to?
Well, it's about a brilliant architect played by Kate Blanchett. She's in semi-involuntary retirement. She finds herself stagnating and increasingly at odds with her neighbors, her community, and even her family. And then she escapes. But not before she gets in really deep with a Russian identity theft ring, a landslide caused by blackberries, a wrongful injury lawsuit. So many weird plot lines. Her husband is a tech guy who has invented software that can read people's minds. We don't know why that's happening.
And that's Billy Crudup.
But all of these plot lines are subservient to her. And she's an unusual character. This is a very strange but really cool movie. She's unlikable, except you love her. And she has nothing to learn except how she needs to go out and do what she needs to do. And by the end of it, you're totally cheering her on, even though she's abandoning everyone.
I can't tell if you like this movie.
Oh, I love this movie.
Oh, okay.
It is sometimes baffling, sometimes just very loosely structured. You don't know where it's going or whether it's going to follow through with any of its plot lines. And then it does and also doesn't at the same time, and I could not have been happier.
I read the book.
Okay.
And so I would think it's a hard one to film because a lot of book is conveyed, a lot of the action or the comedy, I guess, is conveyed in letters and emails and FBI documents and even, you know, bills.
Yeah, and people have been complaining that it's not like the book, which is, you know, tale as old as time. The book and the movie are always going to be two different things. And from what I know about the book, which I've also not read, it seems like it would be impossible to do a straightforward adaptation. But yeah, I love this as a character piece. I love this as a sort of acting showcase for all of these great people. And, you know, a lot of people I talked to who had not even seen the movie were so turned off by the trailer. But one of the things I like about this movie is after watching it, I can't imagine how you would cut a trailer that captures all the strange things this movie is and that this character is.
Yeah, it's hard to sum up.
This is a showcase for Kate Blanchett and her
very
specific sort of comic prickliness and misanthropy that run through the entire film. If you've seen Ghost World, it's as though the character of Enid from Ghost World grew up and became a brilliant architect and kept hating everybody, but she wins.
Okay, now I get it. Maybe also not for everyone's taste, but sounds interesting. Well, next up, there's yet another rock star-based film, Blinded by the Light. It's about a British teen of Pakistani descent who discovers the music of Bruce Springsteen.
I listened to everything. I can feel it all right here. It's like Bruce knows everything I've ever felt, everything I've ever wanted. My poems, they're not brilliant, but they're mine.
You think that this man sings for people like us?
But he talks to me.
Well, that's just self-evident. Bruce does know everything everyone's ever felt.
So, yeah, Vivek Kaura stars as Javed, who is the son of Pakistani immigrants living in Luton, which is a town outside of London. And, yeah, he's turned on to the music of Bruce Springsteen, and it completely changes his life, and he can't stop talking about it because the whole movie is him talking about how great Bruce Springsteen is and how much it's changing his life. And, you know, on the heels of Yesterday, which also gave us a South Asian musician channeling the work of the Beatles, I'm now waiting for a movie about a white British guy whose life is changed by the music of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, because we owe them that. This is a movie that is, it is aggressively the feel-good movie of the summer, and whether or not you are down for that will, I think, you know, be the judge of how much you're into it. It has some of my favorite sequences of any movie this year, when they really just sort of lean into the letting the music take over and letting the character sort of burst into spontaneous joy and dancing or whatever.
It looked cool when they write the lyrics on in the trailer on the wall. Or is that corny? Well, I mean, that was my question, in general.
It is.
It sounds so heartfelt.
It is
movie.
Super corny and super earnest. And for the most part, I think, can kind of get away with it. I was less into it than Dave was, but there were times I was brought to tears by the Born to Run sequence. So I will say that this movie has some stuff going for it, but I also rolled my eyes at a lot of this movie as well. And for somebody who is like supposedly listening to all of the Springsteen albums and getting really into him, this movie kind of sticks to the hits. You know, it quotes Dancing in the Dark and Born to Run and Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Look, it's they only had money to license like five
songs. Oh, come on. Springsteen was on board with this thing. I'm sure they could have gotten Darlington County for a penny, you know.
Okay, you've made your case, Dave.
I should hate this film.
You should.
I should. I hate feel-good movies about kids coming of age and
on principle.
Learning. Yes, yeah. They're terrible most of the time. And they tell you all the wrong lessons, you know. But I am so in love with this movie. It captures something ineffable about being young and finding your identity in one musician or band, and how it consumes you. You become like part of it. You're under the wave of it almost. And you begin dressing like the person that you think is so great. And all their lyrics are specifically about you. It's a movie about fandom and obsession, but not toxically so. You know, because so much now these days with the online fandoms, people go, you know,
the inspirational side of it.
Yes, the wonderful side of it. But more than that, it's about immigration and racism. It's about the devastating legacy of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And it's about how you learn to synthesize the parts of your life that feel like they're at odds with each other. And like I say, like Alonzo just said, it is the corniest movie of 2019.
But you're good with that.
It is so adorable. It's like, you know, when like a dog starts licking your face and it won't stop and you just give in? That's this.
Okay, well, we have, what is that, like 2 eye rolls and 14 dog licks for that one. Let's end with Magic. And that is a documentary about the amazing Jonathan, simply called The Amazing Jonathan Documentary.
Put your hands together for Amazing Jonathan.
The Amazing Jonathan sort of deconstructed magic.
He was like a rebel magician. I loved him.
I performed in over 100 TV shows, made millions of dollars, and everything came crashing down when I was told I had a year to live. It's not a joke.
Okay, so Alonzo, remind us just who the Amazing Jonathan is.
So yeah,
first.
The Amazing Jonathan was this amazing, he's of the school of Penn and Teller and the sort of deconstructionist magic comedians. You know, they weren't coming out and being all David Copperfield and waving their hands around. They were almost kind of punk rock about it in a way. They were sort of pointing out the absurdity of it. They were taking it to much worse physical extremes. He had a trick where, like, he would have a fake tongue that he would stick a spike through, you know, and run the spike up and down, that kind
so
of thing.
So he's funny, and he's kind of myth-busting.
Absolutely. But you know, a really good comedian and a really good magician, and was super successful. A lot of this movie is set in his palatial Vegas estate. He's that kind of, you know, performing comedian magician. But he was diagnosed with a heart ailment He was told that he had a year to live. The documentary picks up 4 years after that, where he is still alive, but, you know, struggling and dealing with health issues. And the movie starts out being a very conventional kind of like, here's this entertainer and he's maybe going to die real soon, doc. But it then takes these turns because the director, Benjamin Berman, finds out from Jonathan that, he's approved another doc crew to come in and make a documentary about his life. So suddenly you've got two different crews trying to shoot the same shows and trying to get these interviews. And then it turns out that there's a third documentary that started years ago that might be coming back, and maybe a fourth one. And then it just gets crazier from there. And so it becomes this movie about documentary making itself, and like, why do documentarians do it? What is it that made Berman want to tell this story? And then also, like, it's also about how much do you trust someone whose life is being an illusionist? And so the film just kind of keeps pulling the rug out from under you in the way that a magician will. You assume one thing is happening and then you find out something else is happening entirely. So in and of itself, I think it works really well, and it is true to its subject by constantly confounding the audience.
And Dave?
Agree. Fully agree. It should be one of those insufferable films where the documentarian inserts themselves into the film, something I can't stand normally. But this becomes so convoluted and so weird. And its subject is such an example of, you know, megalomania that you want to keep watching to find out just how it's all going to resolve itself, or if it's going to resolve itself at all.
Well, great. Let's go to the movies. I'm totally psyched by this whole conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Alonzo Duralde and Dave White review for The Wrap and host the movie podcast Linoleum Knife. Of course, we had to go for this one. That does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Michelle Aloy, Alex Trinkbetotter, Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hardzinski, Adriana Cargill, and Devin Schwartz. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. Amy Taw is our digital producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Mike Stark engineered. And don't forget, you can download or subscribe to Press Play on ksrw.com/pressplay.